it's so apparent how, you know, most lineups behave is still reproducing and reifying Western structures of diversity, which almost starts to feel like the one drop rule, just like, okay, we have one or two black or brown subjects present, we're good. And it's just not a sustainable structure.
Hey, streamers and dreamers, I'm Kike Loma, and you are listening to The Week by Telecom Electronic Beats. It's Thursday, April 18th, and this is your weekly update on music, culture, and what's next. This week, we're talking about one of the most important dance music festivals in the States called Dweller, Coachella, a BPM ban, anti-LGBTQ laws in Georgia, and Earth Day. The first Coachella weekend is over, and there were plenty of surprises, highlights, and mishaps. Lana Del Rey's headline set on Friday included a strange hologram of herself and a guest appearance from Billie Eilish. There were high-energy sets from electronic artists like Two Shell, Justice, and Brutalismus 3000. Everybody's talking about Lil Uzi's dance moves, specifically the dip, oftentimes incorrectly known as the death drop. There were technical issues during Grimes' DJ set, which she later blamed on having outsourced her track organization to someone else to save time. But she promised to sort out the problems for weekend two. Grimes, if you need any help outsourcing your track organization, let me know. I have amazing credentials. I'm a pretty good DJ, and I was a school librarian at age 10. Speaking of Coachella weekend 2, it's still not sold out, and that's for the first time since Coachella went to double weekend format. I'm not too surprised, to be honest. Tickets start at $499, wow. But you can also watch from the comfort of your couch for free. Coachella is streaming their second weekend on YouTube April 19th to the 21st. My personal recommendations from the live stream: Brazilian sensation Ludmilla, fellow Nigerian Tems, and one of my favorite bands from my teens, Vampire Weekend. Everyone knows about Coachella, and by everyone, I mean literally everyone. It's all over Instagram and TikTok, and everyone's talking about their favorite celebrities watching some concert. But we thought we would take this moment to talk about a different festival in the US, specifically one that we feel is one of the most important dance music festivals in the States, Dweller. If you've never heard of Dweller until now, let me tell you what makes it so important. Dweller is one of the few festivals for electronic dance music that highlights the black roots of dance music by focusing on booking and platforming black electronic artists. Dweller was created as a music festival in 2019 in New York City by Discwoman co-founder Frankie Hutchinson. In 2020, they also launched a blog centering black perspectives, and as of 2021, the festival is co-curated and organized by Hutchinson, Ryan C. Clark, and NUMXO. In February this year, Dweller celebrated its fifth anniversary with their biggest edition yet, booking 80 acts in 8 different NYC venues over 5 days. There were acts like Robert Hood, Edward George, Koki, Bebe, Jossie Rebel, Liv Wu-Tang, Actress, High Tech, Nyx, Black Moonchild, and many more. I could go on. The truth is that Dweller's intention and approach in centering black artists and perspectives is really something that should be happening all year, everywhere. But how do you curate and organize an independent festival in New York, let alone one dedicated to black electronic music and musicians who are traditionally overlooked or underrepresented on similar lineups? We invited Ryan C. Clark from Dweller to join us for today's episode. So Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today. This year was actually, for me, the first time I had the chance to attend Dweller. Not only attend Dweller, but play at Dweller as well. Yes. I was playing on the night with DJ Lag and DJ Narcissu and a bunch of others at Paragon. And it was such an incredible experience for me. Like, just it felt almost like a homecoming or like a family reunion, like just the open-mindedness, the energy. I was able to attend a couple of the other events as well. And like, it's also kind of crazy that it's just the three of you, because it's definitely no small feat. I wanted to know what your first experience was like at Dweller. Who do you remember seeing, and like, what did it feel like for you?
Oh gosh. Who did I see? Stingray. I definitely saw Stingray, cause, Kush, Swisha. I didn't get to see DeForest. That was the day before. But really, you know, my whole sort of musical diet was always a sort of internal one. You know, just a headphones kid, never really going to clubs, having a more sort of, I guess the word would almost be voyeuristic, you know, relationship with it, always thinking about it, but not up until that point necessarily, but definitely around that time, I was kind of like a rave baby. And being in those spaces, like you said, where it really sort of felt like a reunion of people that you have and haven't met, and almost this feeling of collective understanding of how we should be treating each other, which, you know, after that, going to different parties, even up in New York, it's always jarring to go to these clubs when it's not during Dweller Week, because there's just a sort of
homogeny.
Yeah, or like an implicit sort of carelessness that I feel like I don't feel when we're at Dweller events. There's sort of like this atmosphere of intention that I'm really thankful that the audience wants to join us in. But regardless, yeah, my first year at Dweller was eye-opening. It was affirming. It was confirming. I think that that was definitely a watershed moment to go, oh, this is really worth giving more of myself to.
Amazing. And I mean, you mentioned that you wanted to bring this kind of archival perspective to your contributions. It started with introducing the blog when you came in. How do you think Dweller has evolved since its inception in 2019?
Oh, wow. I think we have more of a explicit, I almost want to say an explicit epistemology. We're really open to showing our ways that we see the world. And it's always been, you know, and you know, love to Frankie for putting her sort of political foot forward with recognizing this as a social project, which is, I think, is what enticed me about it initially. And so I just started to iterate on that kind of ideology. And from there, yeah, we just have so much more of a sort of research and curatorial arm. For instance, you know, we built up a digital library for the blog. We started to, you know, try to have our own DIY publishing situation with doing interviews and articles. And we try not to do so many mixes because there's a lot of music around. I think we just want to have a sort of a cerebral, somatic relationship with ourselves and whoever wants to check us out. And so what I really love about Dweller is that it seems to behave on a cycle where we can almost have this mental cerebral practice year round. And then at the festival, it just becomes all body language. We kind of have this somatic catharsis that, that I think has changed since 2019. It doesn't need to be a sort of dormant, you know, volcano for 11 months. And then the Dweller machine starts. It tries to just kind of be, not a constant, but definitely a periodical element inside of, I don't know, again, this subcategory of Black culture. And I think that's what I'm most grateful for. We get to be in conversation throughout the year.
I love that. Like so much, as you say, so much intentionality, so much, you know, thought-provoking work goes into this. And to be able to see it come to fruition, it must be so rewarding. I'm curious about what some of the challenges are when it comes to throwing this kind of festival in a city like New York. But on the flip side, are there any opportunities that you think you're able to get in New York that you don't think you're able to get if it was anywhere else?
Yeah. Wow. I think I'll start with the bad news first. I would say that working, doing Dweller in New York is, it feels like an impossible task. It is a city that is so interested in extracting, you know, the life out of certain cultures for its own economic gain. There's so many loopholes and hoops that we have to jump through simply because of, you know, private property and the owners of the private property. And so in trying to have a very sort of particular, I think I've used this word already, so I don't want to go down this rabbit hole again, but I want to say diet, just like who we choose to work with. We've had to be very discerning and to see through the excitement and a lot of the smiles for people that do want to work with us when, you know, again, trying to be a sociocultural or, you know, putting our politics on our sleeves. We want to be true to that. And I think it's really, really hard. We have to be very discerning towards that truth in a place like New York, because it is such a site of power and business that if you walk in with sort of naive eyes, it'll just take you. So that's something that we are always very mindful of. And the good part about working in New York is it is a place that I've never experienced such a strong sense of community and mutual responsibility, that working with others in New York feels like nothing I've ever experienced. You know, you can't trust every smiling face, but the ones that you can, yeah, you really lock in.
There's a quote that Dweller has asserted. In the independent lineage of dance music innovators in Detroit and Chicago, Dweller asserts that we strive to be a black lighthouse, a siren in the storm for those who know the isolating white waters of electronic all too well. Can you maybe unpack the quote a little bit? Like, how do you see Dweller fitting into a longer tradition of black electronic music, both musically and politically?
Yeah, I mean, Underground Resistance, I think, is the sort of closest reference point to our ethos. It's funny to hear that back. I remember writing that in my bedroom in 2020 for a completely different thing, but I was like, this feels like I want to introduce this feeling into Dweller. Well, one, I was continuing through this sort of water motif where the name comes from, Deep Sea Dweller, one of the first releases from Drexia, which is then connected to Underground Resistance through their Submerge label. They were kind of under that umbrella. And so we were already having a sort of textual reference with Underground Resistance in our namesake, but also I think our politic very much aligns with what they were trying to do, which is, yeah, to try to use or instrumentalize music as a push for change. I think their words would be a revolution for change, thinking back to, I think, a 92 compilation of theirs. But yeah, to unpack that quote specifically, to call it a black lighthouse, it has felt like each iteration of Dweller has brought people from across, at this point, the globe together. And it's inside congregation that newness seems to occur, because there's so much intersection of people going on. And so why I was saying it feels like a container or a sort of protective object is, although we can't and we're not interested in sort of dictating necessarily what that change might be, what we have seen is that the act of getting people together or congregating, especially Black people coming together with all this context that we try to set the table out for all these events and parties, seems to galvanize our desire for interdependence and trying to construct a sort of a procedure of generating dignity for everybody working in the industry. Again, if it stays indexed and individualized, we can get oppressed that much more. And so why I love Dweller is that it seems to be, again, a message both to ourselves and to everybody else to recognize that the kind of consistent or drawn out and played out paradigm of tokenism inside the music industry for Black and brown people is just not going to happen. We're not pleased with it anymore, and we're not just going to continue down that path that continues to not work for us. And I'm not even much of an artist, but being on the organizational side of it, it's so apparent how not just festivals, but just how, you know, most lineups behave is still reproducing and reifying Western structures of diversity, which almost starts to feel like the one drop rule, just like, okay, we have one or two Black or brown subjects present, we're good. And you know, that's not a sustainable, it's just not a sustainable structure. And so not even just to, you know, I don't know, it could almost be seen as almost like trying to selfishly, you know, bring ourselves in the room. It's really for the love of the music as well as having a more equitable, both socially and financially or materially or logistical system is going to save the thing that we love. And so, yeah, we're talking about these, what did I say? What was it? The isolating white waters of electronic. And so, yeah, the white water is sort of double entendre, thinking about how the whiteness and how the ideology that you know, subsumes whiteness or white people is something that is ultimately going to drown us all. And so we're just trying to push against that before that happens, if it already hasn't happened. But that's a different conversation.
Okay, last question. Well, it's kind of two questions combined. What are the long-term plans for Dweller? And is there a dream Dweller booking?
Wow, long-term plans. You know, we are having these conversations right now. It was just our fifth, we call it an anniversary. This is our fifth, you know, go around for Dweller just a couple months ago, back in February. And right now, that's so much of our conversation, which is like, where do we want to go? What do we want to do? This year felt like such a total, you know, completion, really. And in so many conversations between ourselves and with outside parties, we're always saying that we're not interested in infinite growth, that every party doesn't need to be bigger than the last. Again, thinking about unsustainable protocols, you know, capitalism is one of them. And we don't want to just fall into that dynamic, you know, again, going into it with excitement. You know, we don't want to just become a sort of, manifestation of more is better, you know, better is bigger. And so we've been thinking about what that means. So I hate to, you know, not give a completely direct answer because I don't think we have a direct answer for ourselves right now. But I would just say that we're not interested in just inflation at all costs each year annually. So whether that means, you know, staying at the capacity that we're at, or maybe gesturing towards a different kind of event at maybe a different place. I'm just talking. This is not anything to confirm, but you know, we're just thinking about what feels good, and if we're providing so much the conditions for intention to take place during the festival, what does it mean for the festival itself structurally to reflect that kind of intention? And so we're giving ourselves the space to navigate what that means, because it could mean a lot. And I think we're really confronted with that, like, oh, we're not even bound by our own past. So what could it mean to move forward? So we don't have that answer. But a dream booking. I mean, personally, I'm such a Detroit techno head. You know, I would love to see and we've had all three of them, but in different years, Mike Banks, Robert Hood, Jeff Mills, you know, like the three OGs of underground resistance, would love them to even be in conversation together. Yeah, I love to give back. And so if there's any sort of dream booking, it would be giving elders their shine. Because I think they were so ahead of the curve that for many of them, their own generation didn't give them a kind of reciprocative love, and to almost right those wrongs is something that I'm personally interested in.
Amazing. Thank you so much, honestly, for taking the time to talk to us and share your insights and your wishes and your backgrounds on the festival. Wishing you an amazing start to your day in New Orleans. Is it sunny at the moment? You got better weather than Europe? Yeah.
The sun came up during this whole conversation. So this is my morning
amazing.
Coffee. Thank you so much, Kike. This is great.
Now let's get into some more news that mattered this week. One of my favorite news items in music from the past week, the Russian Republic of Chechnya has banned all music under 80 and over 116 BPM. If you're not familiar with the term BPM, this stands for beats per minute and refers to the speed of a song. For context, hip-hop and R&B usually sits around 90 to 105 BPM, and house and techno between 120 to 140 BPM. Chechnya, which is north of Georgia and between the Black and Caspian Seas, is an extremely conservative country. They have often banned forms of expression that they say represent Western cultural imperialism, like energy drinks. And this BPM ban goes in the same direction. The Minister of Culture, Musa Dadayev, announced that this ban aimed to maintain, I quote, the peculiarities of Chechen character, which includes the entire spectrum of ethical and moral norms of Chechen life. And he added that borrowing music culture from other peoples is inadmissible. Music theory YouTuber Adam Neely posted a video pointing out that the traditional Georgian dance Lezginka actually goes as fast as 180 BPM, but is usually performed in half time. So Lezginka would still be allowed, but foreign genres that don't fit into that window, even in halftime, aren't. Still, that leaves space for halftime footwork and jungle, and of course, the enormous catalogue of incredible dance music under 116 BPM. I'm Appiana DJs, this is your time to shine. Clubs and promoters in Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, speak out against proposed anti-LGBTQ laws. The Georgian political party DREAM has proposed rules that would ban sex changes, adoption by same-sex couples, and prohibit gatherings aimed at popularizing same-sex family or intimate relationships. Bassiani was one of the many clubs that spoke out against the proposals, saying that this law would pose a direct threat to queer individuals, club culture, the presence of queer parties, and the burgeoning drag culture that has emerged in recent years, representing a vibrant facet of contemporary alternative culture in Georgia. Other organizations like Left Bank and Kiddy also spoke out and have requested a show of international solidarity from artists and dancers against the law. April 22nd is Earth Day, and the Earth Percent organization has highlighted some surprising initiatives. The innovative Earth Percent was co-founded by legendary ambient musician Brian Eno in 2021 and aimed to raise $100 million from the music industries. They did this by asking artists and companies to donate a percentage of their income to the company, which then distributes it to organizations selected by their advisory panel of scientists, literally a percent of income for the Earth. They've raised over $1 million so far and have been highlighting their projects throughout Earth Month, with Earth Day coming up on April 22nd. One of the announcements that caught our eye was this. Ricardo Villalobos, one of the most popular DJs on the planet, has been donating 2% of his live fees for over a year. We're curious to see whether these kinds of percentage-based donations will become more popular as one way of combating the climate crisis. But there is clearly still lots of work to be done. That's all for the week this week. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, Otto Kent will be back as our host with a report from the rebirth of the Stud Bar and Club in San Francisco. So keep your ears open. The Week is a production by Telecom Electronic Beats and ACB Stories.